Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner. We are recording this on Thursday, January 15th, 2015. Just after 3 UTC. As I cough again. You know, we still haven't taken the tree out.
No.
We keep meaning to, but every weekend gets filled up and it doesn't happen. And yeah, so the tree's still in the house.
Boy, we can set it on fire.
Maybe this coming weekend. If we do that, I'm going to suggest to my wife we take it outside first.
That's probably a good idea.
Yeah, because doing that in the living, you know, look, that thing.
They are very flammable.
They are very, and this thing at this point is so dry.
Oh, yeah, like, this thing is tender.
Yeah, you get a flame anywhere near this thing, our whole house is going up. So,
No.
So we're going to try not to do that and actually get this thing outside. Maybe this weekend. Yeah. Or, you know, maybe sometime in March. One or the other.
Yep.
Anyway, we've got a show today. We're going to talk about the economy, because there have been a number of things going on there, I guess. We're going to do a follow-up on the attack in France and all the stuff that's been happening after that. We're going to talk about Obama, what some people are starting to call Obama Unleashed. I forget who I saw use that term earlier today.
Not later today.
I sometimes remember the future, but not usually.
Not usually. Okay.
Not all usually. Right.
Making sure.
Because basically he's been going on ever since the election, he's been doing one major thing or another every week or so.
Every freaking week. I mean, I'm like,
some of which are real and some of which are just announcements of things that people
but still,
have to discuss. But anyway, still. So we'll talk about Obama. And then, of course, Romney. We're going to talk about Romney.
Romney.
You know, we'll leave it for them. There's some stuff to say about Romney. Anyway, before getting into even the economy stuff, I did want to say, I promise this does not actually happen every single week, even though it may seem like it. I finished another book. In this case, it was an audiobook called Reckless Endangerment. Have you heard of this book, Yvonne?
Nope.
So the theme of this book, basically, it's a nonfiction book. It's an accounting of basically the real estate crisis that led up to the financial crisis in, what was it, 2007?
2008.
Yeah, so basically, it chronicles sort of the history of, like, Fannie and Freddie and the mortgage market and the various changes that were made that allowed people to go after some subprime loans and the various trading instruments that were constructed on top of them and all of the regulatory shenanigans one way or another in some case that basically opened things up and allowed a lot of this to happen, and also a lot of the lobbying that went on that made sure any laws or regulations that happened were completely basically
toothless.
Toothless and in some cases more than toothless, in some cases specifically designed to enable these behaviors on the part of Fannie and Freddie and
financial institutions. I mean, one of the biggest things that happened that's been documented, a couple of different documentaries, has been the changes in terms of what happened in Wall Street, in terms of the ability of Wall Street firms to carry how much leverage and how they were packaging securities. Yep. And how they were able to basically get them rated AAA, even though they were, like, for the most part, garbage.
Well, all the incentives, was all aligned to discourage people from actually doing due diligence and from actually, like,
correct,
advocating in favor of the actual consumer at the end of these transactions. Right. Everything was rigged at every level to try to let the financiers squeeze as much money as possible out of everything before it all went to hell.
Absolutely. It just was. And
you know, the primary themes, I'm just getting the author name just so I have it in front of me. But the primary impression that all of this left of me with me was, you know, to quote Star Wars, you know, the hive of scum and villainy. You know, there were a few cases of just incompetence, but the vast majority of it was people being outright corrupt.
No, they were being outright crooks, and they know it. I mean, you had so many people just giving outright so many mortgages to so many people that they knew had no ability to repay, and they were basically just gambling money on, oh, well, they'll refi, they'll sell, they'll never, you know.
And things are going to go up, 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 so we never have to worry about it.
Exactly. Absolutely.
And, you know, so just for the full reference here, this is a book from 2011. The full title is Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon by Gretchen Morgenson and Joshua Rosner. And at the first part of the book, I was actually getting a little bit annoyed because they kept talking about it looked like it was almost a screed because the first part, it was all seemed like it was blaming it on the Clinton administration and Barney Frank and their efforts to sort of open up home ownership to everybody. And that definitely there was a contributing factor in terms of.
But that wasn't the major factor at all.
And the first quarter of the book, I was like, this is getting annoying. It's not all this. But then it opened out. And by the end, they were slamming basically everybody possibly involved, you know, the bankers, the regulators, Congress, everybody, you know, the Clinton administration got it at the beginning, but the Bush administration got plenty once they were in charge, you know, and so all around. And of course, it ended with an appendix basically listing all of the players that were involved and what they're doing now, which in most of the cases was, you know, they made out quite well. Many of them are still in positions of significant power right now. And, you know, because of course, one of the points here is all of this stuff happened. There was all this corruption. There was all this manipulation of the system.
Nobody is in jail.
Nobody is in jail.
Nobody.
Almost
nobody.
You know, and
nobody.
And for the most part, the people who got rich off of this stayed rich. They may have lost some money, but they certainly weren't in the poorhouse.
Well,
you know?
Here's one of the things that happened. When the stock market crashed, a lot of people got scared and basically bailed all their money out. Okay? They turned into cash. The biggest problem that happened is that the stock market rebounded. Mm-hmm. So if you were scared off by the crash and you didn't stay invested in equities, you never made the money back. Right. And a lot of people in our economy did not.
Yeah.
Okay. That's why a lot of these people stayed rich. I mean, I'm not gonna lie. I stayed invested in the stock market substantially after the crash. If you go back to the podcast, Sam knows.
Oh, yeah.
I was not a happy camper when the stock market was crashing. He knows. But I tell you what, that I made a hell of a lot of money back when it came back. Okay?
Right. You know, but anyway, the bottom line is, I liked the book. It's good. I think it was worth reading. It's a good overview of the things. I think you could probably criticize it on the grounds of they focused on some very specific things and some specific players. Like they really were very concentrated on, you know, sort of Fannie and Freddie and the mortgages directly. But by the time everything exploded, there was a lot more involved as well. And they got into some of that.
But you have
to pick somewhere to focus, I guess. And also the only other thing is it seemed like there was lots and lots of on how all the lead up, but actually relatively little of the period actually when everything was falling the hell apart. And I'd be interested in, and of course there are other books on that, I'd be interested in getting more books on or reading more on specifically, you know, the 1 year where everything was falling to shit, whereas this had like the last chapter was on that last year and the rest was on like the 15 years leading up to it and everything that led to that point.
No, it's very, no, it sounds good.
So anyway, good book. I would recommend it.
Okay.
And so real quick, just segueing off of that,
Segway, yeah.
Yeah. I keep
Well, you're not going to go and crash into a Segway and get killed like the guy who owned it, are you?
No, I was thinking of the little scooter things, but
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I know.
You don't doubt that
I'm not going to fall off it like, you know, George Bush did or whatever. Was it the senior right. Bush or the junior Bush who did that? I forget.
Senior Bush.
Yeah. Anyway, we do have a couple economic things to talk about real quick, and I mean real quick. There's not a lot, but okay. Okay, Yvonne, so two things. One, I've saw a lot of like panic tweeting going on with the stock market going up and down and then sideways. And is there anything
I think
going on here?
Yes, there's two things going on. One is everybody's freaking out about what the hell the actual impact of collapsing oil prices. Okay? Mm-hmm. The U.S. in the last, for the most part, really, during the Obama administration so much has become quite a big oil producer. There's been quite a lot of oil jobs. So a lot of people are freaking out about what the hell the impact is of a falling oil price going to be on the U.S. economy. I still think that it's a net positive. I know it's going to have negative impacts on obviously a lot of those oil jobs because a lot of those are going to start retrenching. But I think it's going to be a net positive. So when a lot of people are freaking out, they don't know what the impacts are. There's just a lot of freaking out going on about it. So that's the one thing.
In the end, you think this is people freaking out about something that in the end is going to be a positive. So any downturns are temporary and we'll be heading back up soon enough.
Because usually a falling, you know, the last times that we've had these kinds of oil price shocks, outside of when, you know, the last one we had was after the financial crisis. The reason why oil went down after a financial crisis was because everybody was broke. There's the demand was collapsing. So that doesn't – you taking that out, almost every other time, it's been a net positive for the economy, a huge net positive for the economy.
Okay.
So I think that people are freaking out about it right now. But there's also a whole bunch of other factors. There was a retail sales report that, although good, people didn't think it met expectations. There's still a lot of concern about Europe and what actions the European Central Bank is going to take in order to stimulate the European economy, which is still in the shitter, okay? And it just doesn't seem to get out of it, okay? And there are concerns about Russia, China. There's just a lot of macroeconomic concerns.
Gotcha. So just, you know, as we wrap up this segment, one more thing. How's Bitcoin doing, Yvonne?
Crashing! 180.
And as I tweeted, Yvonne was 12 days off in his prediction of Bitcoin going below 250 by the end of the year.
Yeah.
It went below 250 on the 12th, on January 12th, I believe.
And it kept on going. It's down to about 180.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I, you know, it's like with these speculative things, I didn't see how the hell else it wouldn't happen that way anyway.
Right.
So,
now, a lot of people are saying that, again, this is the collapse of the bubble in terms of it as a speculation, but there's still some underlying technology stuff here that, yeah, the underlying technology here may be of continued value. And Bitcoin as a method of doing transactions doesn't give a shit if it's at $10,000 or $1, as long as you're just buying what you need, transferring it, and pulling it back out again. What's been collapsing is the idea of using this as a long-term investment to make money, and you've also seen the Bitcoin miners basically shutting down operations because it's below the level where it's worth the electricity and hardware to do the mining.
Well, the thing is, for the time being, well, it goes back to, you know, one of the arguments I kept having with people, all these people that thought about, you know.
Time's up for the segment.
Time's up for the segment, but I'll just finish. Investing in gold. Investing in gold is a stupid thing. Okay? It's just the same as Bitcoin. You're buying into a store of value. It's not an investment that's going to grow. So.
Right. Anyway. Well, the gold from anybody who talks about a lot is typically not described as an investment to grow. It's described as insurance.
A lot of people believe but a lot of people believe it is. So
yeah, okay, but I've typically heard people talk about it more as you want the gold to hold on to when the entire world economy collapses around you. You'll still have
to gamble. Some people do that, but there are people who believe it's a good investment. There's a lot of people who believe it's a good investment, and it's not.
Okay. We'll take a break. We'll be back, and we'll talk about France next. Back after this.
France.
You're in the Valley, AM 1620, and LiganAirRadio.com. This is where you'll find your favorite songs. Everybody's doing a brand new dance now. Classic music for a classic American town, AM 1620, and in stereo at LiganAirRadio.com, The Valley.
Okay, we're back. So
we're back.
When we last spoke last week.
Last week, last spoke, last something. Yep.
Last winter. I don't know. Anyway,
it is very cold in Texas.
Is it? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which I happen to be in Texas.
You're in Texas today. You just are moving all over the place.
I know.
At least you have internet in Texas.
Yes, there is good internet here, thankfully.
When we last talked about this, things were very much in flux. The attacks had happened. There were three people on the run. One person had turned himself in. That person did indeed turn out to be innocent.
Okay, that's good.
The person who turned himself in, he had been named as a suspect. He's like, oh, crap. he called the police. He turned himself in. He had nothing to do with it.
Okay, well, that was smart. At least give him credit. Straight up and do that.
However, the other people involved proceeded to take hostages at a Jewish grocery store. And then they had other people involved who took hostages somewhere else. One of the suspected people, and then there was a standoff and then they were killed by the police, blah, blah, blah. One of the people who was suspected to be related, which I guess was the wife or the girlfriend of one of them, has actually escaped to Syria. The Turkish government confirmed that she, went across the border from Turkey into Syria. And they're like, well, you didn't put them on a watch list for us to look out for. Sorry. And then there have been some reports that there's still potentially other members of this ring who are still at large in France. But I think that's been unconfirmed. And of course, then we had this this big rally, this big We Are Charlie rally of approximately 4 million people across France. And a bunch of world leaders took part. Netanyahu was there, even though he wasn't invited. Obama was not there. And a lot of people have made hay about that.
Was he invited?
Netanyahu? No,
Obama.
I have not heard anyone say specifically one way or another whether he was invited. The administration has admitted that they made a mistake in not sending someone more senior. They sent the American ambassador to France. The American ambassador to France did go. But there's a fairly, at first people were like, the president should have gone. But there are a lot of logistical challenges there in terms of security.
Which I totally agree. I thought it was just logistical nightmare.
And presidents have typically not gone to this kind of thing in the past. However, it would have been perfectly reasonable to send Kerry or Biden.
I agree with that. I thought it was a logistical nightmare to try to send Obama, but I think somebody else, whether it was Kerry or Biden, should have been there.
Yeah. I mean, really, there's no excuse that Biden couldn't have been there.
No, I agree. I agree.
You know, I fully understand the logic of not sending Obama in a number of different reasons. And one that people have pointed out is Obama's been raked over the coals for not going. But let's see, if he had been there, He's there arm in arm with, you know, socialist president of France. Habas was there from the Palestinian territories. All kinds of other people were there. He'd be shown to be visibly supporting these cartoons that, even though everybody's, a whole bunch of people are We Are Charlie, there was also significant backlash over the week in terms of, wait a second, these guys are racist assholes.
Right.
You know, and some of their cartoons were, I mean, there have been some arguments that it's a subtle, they're actually poking fun at the racist, whatever, you know, but look, yeah, so he would have lost no matter what he did. No matter what he did, people would have been yelling at him about it. However, you know, Biden or Kerry should have been there.
Agreed.
Now, and also so some of the aftermath that's come up too is, since this has happened and all these rallies about free speech and everything, apparently France has arrested on the order of 50 plus people for making comments that could be construed as supporting the terrorists in this case.
Right.
So it's like, okay, you tried that free speech thing for 2 days and it wasn't working out for you, I guess. they're trying to distinguish, well, but these are hate speech and incited to violence, and that wasn't. And yeah, that's a very difficult line to cross. And it's been pointed out by a number of people this week that, you know, the U.S. is actually the only major Western country where this kind of stuff is actually legally protected.
Correct.
And in almost all countries across Europe, there are all sorts of restrictions on free speech, against hate speech of various sorts. You know, you can't, in Germany, you can't say anything pro-Nazi, and, you know, you kind of understand where that history comes from, but still, you know, and there are a lot of laws all over Europe that are actually fairly restrictive of free speech and supporting quote-unquote unpopular positions. Now, many of these unpopular positions aren't ones that I would particularly support myself, but, you know, as we talked a little bit about last week, I think that the principle that even people with horribly unpopular positions, even people that I would say have evil positions, should be able to express those opinions and have you argue them out in public debate. You know, show how they're wrong. Don't shut them up. You know?
Right.
But, you know, that's just not the reality in most of Europe. And so, you know, there's been a lot of people pointing out sort of the hypocrisy of this. And, you know, is it really just the anti-Muslim speech that you think is okay? Like, making fun of Muhammad is okay, but, you know, if you say something that indicates, well, you know, maybe there's some legitimate reasons to whatever, and you're then all of a sudden you're beyond the pale. And I think the basic problem is with government deciding what's beyond the pale. I mean, as long as it's just speech. I mean, the second you pull out a gun and start shooting people, it's a whole different picture. But if you're sort of talking about how decadent the West is and how, you know, you need to fight against the decadence of the West, and even for that matter, saying that, you know, violence might be appropriate in certain circumstances, you know, that's a legitimate debate. I mean, if you think about it, you know, from our side, I mean, when we're just going into the Iraq war, what was that about? That was a public debate about whether it was okay to go in and kill people to gain our political viewpoints, you know, to push the world policy in the direction that we wanted. So, I mean, that debate can't be okay if you're debating, is it okay for the U.S. to go bomb somebody, but not okay if you're debating, is it okay for Al-Qaeda to go bomb somebody? You know, they're both the same debate, and you may have different answers to the question about who you think is okay to bomb and who you don't, but it's part of the discussion. And you can't just say, you know, The people who are advocating, you know, Al-Qaeda's point of view, just because they're advocating that point of view alone, you know, need to be shut up or put in jail or whatever. You know, there's a difference between arguing the political view and actually going out and doing stuff.
No, I agree, and that's been. It's like you mentioned. I mean, this is such a difficult thing. Okay, but I think that, like you said before, I think that in the U.S. we protect this speech in general far more than almost any other country.
Yep.
I think that the point that we make about it is it's a very simple point. People, you are open to say what you want. It doesn't mean that a lot of people aren't going to hate you for it.
Right.
Okay? If people disagree with it. It's simple as that. You know, just showing on the TV as we're talking about this, and I had the TV on, and they're showing videos of like the LA Clippers, and I don't know if you remember the controversy about the owner of the team saying quite a lot of racist remarks and being forced to sell the team. You know, like I said, I mean, you know, the guy was saying, well, my free speech is not being abrogated, you know, being denied. I'm like, no, it's not. You can say it, but hey, there's going to be consequences to you saying something like that. You owned a team inside a league that is a private club, basically, and they can force you to sell it. If the other owners don't want you, they can force you out because they don't like you. It's as simple as that.
Right.
Can they take away your house? No. Can they take away your money in the bank? No. But they sure as hell don't have to be forced to do business with you, especially when you're not in a – you know, this is not a public thing. You're in a private club. You're getting kicked out, period.
Yeah.
They don't want you.
And nobody in particular has to provide you a platform to talk either.
No, not at all.
They can choose to, or they might not.
But if they don't, they don't have to give you the platform.
And I'm actually generally in favor of, like, you know, semi-public platforms like Twitter or Facebook or whatever. I think while they clearly have the right to censor whatever they want, should lean towards letting people express themselves as much as possible. But that's their choice.
That's true.
It's not something that should be mandated anywhere. In any case, one of the things, just to finish up this topic, we're just like everybody else, we're not going to talk a lot about Boko Haram in Nigeria, but the point has been made repeatedly this week that the grand total of people killed in France was what, 17 somewhere around there. Reports vary in terms of what's happened in Nigeria, but most reports seem to have the death toll around 2,000. But which one is getting the massive parade and world leaders coming from all over the place?
Of course.
And which one is getting all the attention? Well, Paris. You know,
right.
And the other one, you know, there are no cameras. There's no like cell phone video that came out of it. I mean, there have been some pictures that made it out, but it wasn't real time. It wasn't as it was happening. There's no live international press corps there. The first reports of this came out days after it actually happened. And, you know, it's in a faraway place that most Westerners don't think about all that much. And also there's sort of the general thought that the sort of movement and issues that were surfaced in France are potentially sort of one step on the way to being a threat to, quote unquote, us. Whereas people don't feel that way about what's going on in Nigeria. And from what I've read, you know, that is much more a local thing going on, and with less sort of international ambitions than, say, Al-Qaeda or ISIS or whatever have. But still, it's, you know, we completely lose our shit over 17 people killed in France.
Well, I was mentioning to you that there were like about 60 to 70 people that I believe it was in Mozambique, I think it was, that somebody went and like died because somebody went at a funeral, poisoned beer that was being served from a homemade beer with like crocodile bile, if I remember correctly. Okay. And yeah, they killed 68 people, and we're not paying attention to that either. I mean, that was like basically a mass murder on a much bigger scale.
Yeah, and we talked before about how there was this major school killing in Pakistan, and yes, it made the news for a couple days, but also got nowhere near the attention. You know, it's it's all again the basic idea of like, if it's people who are sort of white Westerners, we pay a hell of a lot of attention. If it's some random place in Africa or Asia or wherever,
we don't. It's true.
And it's not necessarily the way it should be, but it is the way it is today.
Yep.
You know, and yep. Anyway, time up for this segment, and we'll be back, and we'll talk about Obama next, I guess. Back after this.
Obamba. Okay, good.
Obamba?
Yeah.
Is
no? La yeah. Bamba?
No. Like La Bamba, but Obamba?
Yeah.
Are you going to sing it?
No, not today.
Okay, we'll be back after this.
Ready for the test, Dracula? I'm ready. Frankenstein, then. Let us begin.
Creepy Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
Okay, we are back, and before we get into the next topic, I just want, you know, during the break, Yvonne and I looked up this the beer case he was talking about, because I hadn't heard about it before. I got an article in the Washington Post: at least 72 in Mozambique are dead after drinking poison beer, posted on January 13th, the article. Yeah, I'm not trying to read the details here, but yeah, poisoned beer, and then people died.
Yeah,
nice.
A lot of people.
Just what you wanted.
At a funeral,
A funeral. Yeah, I was going to say
funeral.
Wedding.
No, it's not at a wedding. It was a funeral. Jeez.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on that cheery note. I should say also. Yeah. Speaking of the international terrorist threat or whatever. I noticed when I was going to Google News to look this up, the number one thing on the list right now is ISIS sympathizer allegedly plotted terror assault against U.S. Capitol and was arrested in Ohio on Wednesday. So,
oh, there you go.
And plotting shooting and bombing attack on the U.S. Capitol. And
apparently, was that the guy that was like, say, I saw on the news, like, while I was working out this morning, which I actually did something. My God, I worked out. In the morning, I don't normally do that, but I was on this business trip and I did that. But anyway,
it's a different
there was like
guy.
These things flashing about somebody trying to kill Bonner.
Now that was a different guy.
That was a different guy.
Yeah. So there was also, you know, somebody who worked at Bonner's Country Club or something, who was mentally unstable and had threatened him in a number of different ways, including that. Apparently his most recent plot was he was going to shoot him, but he'd been quoted as saying, hey, if I could have poisoned you any number of, many times, whatever. And apparently the indictments against him were because he was being released from the psychiatric hospital where he had been being capped. So this is a disturbed person in this case. And
that guy's just a...
And who knows if he was actually going to ever actually do something with Bonner. Maybe not, but you never know. You know, John Hinckley did shoot Reagan.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, so it does happen, you know, plenty of disturbed people do plenty of disturbed things. In any case, I was just going to say on that ISIS Capitol thing, one thing that people should not be surprised on, like something of the scale that happened in France is not actually that huge. I mean, really, it looks like there are more than two people involved, and you know, Al-Qaeda has claimed credit and blah blah blah, they helped fund whatever, and it's unclear whether we should believe them or not, but there's clearly they had lots of connections, they'd trained in Syria, they'd done this, whatever. But bottom line is, it doesn't take very much for a couple guys hell-bent on doing something to do it. We saw that with the Boston bombing. We've seen this with the guys who shot up movie theaters. We saw that with the sniper case in D.C. over a decade ago. Like, these cases where if you're talking about grabbing, you know, a small group of people, two or three people, who gather together either firearms or bomb making material or whatever, you know, that's very, very hard to stop. And so we shouldn't be surprised if it happens. And if it does happen, we shouldn't turn our whole society upside down to try to stop it from happening again. You know, we've had Timothy McVeigh. We've had the Atlanta Olympic bomber. We've had the snipers in D.C. We've had the Boston guys. And, you know, you will occasionally have incidents like that. And should we do reasonable things to make ourselves safer? Sure.
Yes.
Absolutely. However, absolutely, we can't turn everything upside down because there's no possible thing, even a complete and total police state of, you know, the sort unimaginable so far in the U.S. could stop all such incidents, or even right, or even reduce them significantly. To be honest, there's all of this, you know, protections we could put in place. You know, okay, maybe we'll stop.
We can do what we can.
But the danger in all of these cases is the overreaction and the, oh crap, somebody shot a couple people, therefore we have to throw out everything we hold dear and give up all our civil liberties in order to protect against this. And sometimes
people sometimes forget that it's not like this country is always, I mean, how many times have we had like shootings or attacks on the president over history? Even Congress. I don't know if I get more dramatic and go back. I mean, geez, didn't the British go and like frickin' burn down Washington, for God's sakes?
Oh, yeah. Well, and the other thing to remember that whenever people start really freaking out, whether it's about school shootings or terrorist attacks or anything like this, is that if you look on the long-term scale and actually look at the numbers instead of these anecdotal reports, not just in the U.S., in the U.S. certainly, but also worldwide.
Worldwide.
Including your chances of dying a violent death from war or crime or anything else.
Are way down.
And in fact, they're essentially the best they've ever been in human history. And there's been a dramatic downward trend, certainly in the last 20 years, but even further, if you look back in the last few hundred years, you know, the trend has been down, 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 down.
Which is why I'm always an optimist about this. You know, I know that we've talked about in this program many times about the Palestinian conflict, how it just never seems to end, and some of the other conflicts. I think people, and almost all these conflicts, they eventually get tired. I mean, they do, and they figure out a way to settle their differences. It just always has worked out that way.
And it's hard to remember history sometimes, but you got to remember, like, you know, as scary as people make out like these various terrorist threats to be, it's nothing compared to, you know, the 1960s, 70s, and 80s fear of global annihilation through World War III.
Hell yes, absolutely.
And it's nothing.
I tell you what, that I was thinking about that the other day. I mean, there was something about the anniversary, about the movie The Day After. Okay, and we're talking about that.
Yeah.
And I realized, I mean, how that was in our conscious mind so present at that time. I mean, we lived in constantly in a concern about being completely freaking annihilated, maybe in like 30 minutes, you know, on a nuclear attack. And I mean, we're not worried about that.
The nuclear arsenal still exists. It could still happen, but it's not something that people are, you know, actively worried about at this point.
Yeah. Nobody thinks that the Russians are going to launch a mass nuclear strike. Let me put it to you this way. Even if Russia, for some reason, launched a nuclear missile by accident, okay, or like a couple got through, I don't, you know, it's not like we're before. I don't think that we launched a, like back then we were, oh, we're launching a full retaliatory strike.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, even the people who are, you know, talk all the time about how evil and dangerous Putin is, aren't talking about, oh yeah, and he's going to nuke Denver.
Yeah, no, no, no.
You know, and just there was a recent article about this. I noticed Vox.com had something actually on January 14th. Ignore the headlines. The world is getting safer all the time. That summarizes some of this stuff. But as you said, we've talked about that before. It's an ongoing trend. It's just very easy to lose sight of when you're talking about the problems of today.
Right.
Which look horrible. But then all you have to do is, okay, they look horrible and they are horrible. And
you got to compare them to what?
And we can do a lot better. We can definitely
do a lot better. Oh, my God. Yes, we can do a lot better.
Yeah, it's absolutely not at all saying that absolutely we should be satisfied with the status quo.
No,
but if you compare to where things were 30, 40, 50 years ago, we're so much better.
Yes.
And it's important to keep that in mind. Okay. We talked more about that than I expected. Obama Unleashed. So, yes. You know, basically, since the election, so the latest thing, you know, of course, soon after the election, he did his executive orders on immigration. Yep. Then he did the opening with Cuba. In the last week, there have been two of these. He announced an initiative on free community college.
Yep.
And I tweeted at the time that he was, you know, doing a masterful job of trolling the Republican Congress there, because and I'll talk about that more in a second. The one that was just in the last 24 hours is he's also announcing an initiative on changing some FCC regulations that would undo the laws that some states have passed prohibiting some cities from paying for their own broadband systems.
Wait a minute. Explain that to me again.
Okay, so right now, what's happened is there were a whole bunch of cities that were really hot on the idea of building out broadband infrastructure for their cities.
Everybody. Okay.
They would do, and not, we're not talking free broadband, but they would like make a deal with the electric company to run fiber or something like that, and build something that would essentially compete against sort of the AT&Ts and the Comcasts of the world, but be partially funded by local taxpayer dollars.
Okay.
And then some states, and I believe it's about half of the states, passed laws prohibiting their cities from doing that.
Why?
Because of the notion that that's the public funding, taxpayer money competing with private enterprise, and this should be a domain of private enterprise, not the public.
Okay.
And so then, and the current FCC regulations don't say anything on that, which means state law prevails. However, the FCC has the power where they could pass a regulation that would override the state laws.
Okay.
And allow this again. So basically, the federal government could pass a regulation that prohibits the states from prohibiting the cities from funding public broadband in their cities.
Okay.
In any case, the end result in like some of the cities that have done this in the states that have allowed, it basically builds up more competition because in many of these cases, they're able to provide megabit speeds. So 10 to 20 times faster than what most Americans have today for approximately the same price for, you know, around $70 a month or whatever, that a lot of cable companies are selling their current packages.
Right.
And so the idea here is to spur additional competition. Like when we've talked about net neutrality before, one of the arguments that's always brought up is that one of the reasons why you can't trust the market here is because you have all of these arrangements that provide monopolies or near monopolies, where there are only one or two broadband providers in a given region.
In a given marketplace, that's correct, yes.
And this kind of thing could provide a lot more competition because in some of these cases, even though the new fiber is built out by the electric company or whatever, they actually release that to any number of providers who want to actually sell the service to consumers, who can then compete against each other on the same hardware. So, you know, anyway, the idea is to spur competition.
Well, but, look, one of the things about broadband access and the way it is for, like, right now and how it's priced and so forth is that we have a digital divide in the country. We have haves and have-nots.
Yeah.
There is still a substantial number of people in the U.S. that don't have access to broadband. The fact that they don't have access to that currently in the way that our economy and our educational system is and so forth, what we're doing is we're relegating certain people to not being as educated as they should be and as connected as they could be. And we're really impacting their development and growth.
Yeah,
and so, education.
So I know time is up, but I do want to make a point here because I didn't want to get into the merits of either the free community college or the broadband. I think the point of these two is in both of these scenarios, Obama's proposing something. Well, especially the second one, potentially the FCC can do this, and so he can do that without Congress. And of course, that'll really infuriate the Republicans once again. But of course, he can't directly tell the FCC to do this. He has suggested to the commissioner that because the commissioner is an independent theoretically and can do what he wants. But on the free community college, this potentially would require congressional action to do. Now, but what's interesting here is chances are, yeah, this wouldn't pass a Democratic Congress, but it might, but there's enough Democratic resistance to the whole idea of the federal government funding more and being even more involved in these initiatives and, giving away shit for free. And it's got a $60 billion price tag and all this kind of stuff. This probably wouldn't even pass a Democratic Congress. But in both of these cases, what he's doing is he's putting something on the table that has a very obvious potential positive value to a significant group of people. And the negative sides from the Republican side, the reasons the Republicans don't like these are much more, theoretical, philosophical, what's the proper role of government type of questions. We shouldn't provide free community college because it's not the proper role of government to do that. But then what he's forcing the GOP into is a position where, Obama is saying, I think more people should have the opportunity to get educated and we're going to help. And the Republicans are saying, screw Fuck that. We don't want to help them. And on the broadband thing is Obama's like, I want to try to get better, high quality broadband to more people for less money. And the Republicans are going, hell no, we don't want that.
I know.
I just want to say this real quick. The Republicans may in fact have legitimate arguments they can make why it would be better to accomplish these goals through some other way that didn't involve government. That's a real debate that people could have. But Obama's backed them in a position where those subtle arguments get lost when you're because no one wants to hear like a detailed philosophical or intellectual argument about the best way to provide broadband to more people. And is it with the government being involved or not being involved? And is it okay for cities to do this or not? Or on community college, is it somehow better if people pay for their own community college rather than getting it free? All the message that actually gets out is Obama is trying to help people specifically.
And the Republicans that are giving you the finger, right?
Yes. So I saw these two initiatives and I'm like, oh, that is just, I said it was.
Yeah. But my point is that I still say this again. I don't understand why the hell he didn't do any of this stuff before the damn midterm.
Here's why. Because, and I saw a couple articles on this and I forget if I tweeted them or not, but the politics of the situation is that if he had done this before the election, he was probably going to lose the Senate anyway.
Yeah.
The House, he was probably going to lose seats in anyway. Arguably, this kind of thing could have made Democratic candidates look get pilloried even more. And
you think?
He might have lost even more. But here's the thing. Even if he didn't, even if they didn't change the election results one iota, if he had done this stuff before the election, then the election itself could be spun as a repudiation of those actions.
Mm.
And it was the public rejecting all of those policies.
And yeah, I think, by doing it after
the election, it no longer has, you know, there's no election that can be said, oh, the public has rejected what Obama is doing. Instead, it's building momentum for 2016. And what do the Republicans have to say now? You know, and again, he's backing him into these corners. Now, of course, the Republicans are trying to do the same thing, you know, in terms of, you know, Keystone and other things, and Obama's trying to stop these things that would help the economy, and they're trying to do, both sides are trying to do the same thing where they're trying to make the other side look like the bad guy. But I think so far Obama's done a better job of it.
Well, and the Republicans didn't do themselves any favors by voting to like try to like veto like this whole thing that Obama did against the Dreamers.
Yep.
And immigration too, which Republicans were voting to try to like curtail it, which they're pretty sure is not going to get through the Senate, but they're not making themselves look very good by doing that. But I have a counter argument. To this, because I think that one of the biggest problems that the Democrats had in this midterm election was apathy. Okay, yeah. A lot on the Democratic base,
and this kind of stuff is getting the Democrats excited again.
Exactly,
especially the more progressive Democrats.
Exactly.
The stuff he's doing right now is centrists may get interested, but he's doing the kind of stuff that the more left-wing Democrats have been wishing he would do for the last 6 years.
And the problem is that this is the kind of stuff that would have gotten turnout from the base, which is one of the reasons why the Democrats didn't do so well in the midterm election. And I really think that if he would have done a lot more of this earlier, instead of, you know, the analysis saying, well, you're screwed anyway. Let's go. If you're telling me that he'd gone back during the year and done a lot more of this, I think you're probably gonna have gotten and would have gotten his base more fired up. They would have turned up the freaking vote.
Maybe it's hard to do the counterfactual.
Hindsight's 2020. I know.
And who knows? It might have worked. It might not have worked. It might have backfired. Like right. A lot of people are saying. But you know, this reminds me. There was apparently an interview that Obama did 2 or 3 years ago, where he talked about, you know, the increasing desire to, quote unquote, go Bullworth.
Nah.
And I don't know how many people remember. I actually never saw this movie. I only read summaries of it.
I saw parts of it.
But Bullworth was a movie, what was it, 80s or 90s?
90s.
But basically the idea was that it was a politician who decided that, you know, he had no chance, he was going to lose the election, whatever, so fuck it. He was going to do the things he really wanted to do.
Right.
And screw the politics of it, screw whatever happened. And the end result of this was, you know,
he was
got
more popular than ever.
He got a bunch of stuff done. He was more popular than ever. He won his election, whatever. But the key was, it was the politician who was unleashed. And that's why people are saying Obama unleashed here, because all of a sudden he's not worrying about how's this going to appear. And he's just like, fuck it. This is the thing I want to do. I have a way to do it. I'm going to goddamn do it.
Right.
And it actually helps in this case that he's now got a Republican Congress, because if Congress is a holdup, you know, he can just do the big middle finger to Congress and say, well, fuck you, I can do this anyway.
Right.
Whereas he might have been held back by the Democratic Senate
Democrats
a little bit.
Himself. Right.
You know,
right.
Because they're, yeah. But now it's like, I got nothing to lose.
Right.
I'm not up for re-election. There's no other Democrats, you know, that are hanging on my every move to determine their election. So it's not like he's being held back by the congressional elections. And, you know, frankly, Hillary or whoever's running on his side is going to be distancing herself from him anyway, regardless of what the hell he does, to present herself as something new rather than a continuation. And so screw that. He can do whatever the fuck he wants. And I'm actually like, this is fun to watch. And you also saw there are a number of people, you had mentioned, on one of our last couple shows, an uptick in his approval ratings.
Yes.
And when you first mentioned that, that was very, there were a couple of polls, but it wasn't enough to be conclusive yet. At this point, a number of folks have commented on how that trend has continued. It has been dramatic, and it's out of the margin of error of these polls and their normal variability. And there's something real happening in the polls in the last few weeks. I think one thing I said to start, it looks to have started around the middle of December, around the time of the Cuba initiative.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, you know, some of the commentaries, hey, look, maybe people actually like politicians who do stuff.
Exactly.
You know, and you know, and I think there's some truth to that, in that, you know, even beyond, you know, do you agree with what he did or not, a president who looks like he's being decisive and getting shit done,
it's a lot more attractive.
Even if you disagree with some of the specifics of what you're doing, right. A lot of people look at it and say, nod his head, at least he's doing something.
Right.
Of course, a lot of people are also, and you know, oh my God, he's doing something. He shouldn't be doing something. Look how evil he is. I subject myself to a whole bunch of political podcasts, including ones by various right-wing radio talk show hosts. And, you know, I listened to a few of them, and specifically the one I listened to most recently was Savage. And you know, the whole thing was about how, like, you know, how bad Obama was and this and that, and how he's evil and he's, you know, he's got this, you know, supporting the Muslims anti-Israel agenda. I'm like, come on. But
he is so pro-Muslim. He's bombing the shit out of them, for God's sake. Sending drones up their ass. Yeah, I know, he's so pro-Muslim.
Whatever. Anyway, the point is, people like that are never going to be convinced by anything.
No, not really.
But that critical swing group in the middle that actually maybe doesn't pay that much attention to specific policy issues and the philosophy of government and, you know, all of this kind of stuff, they see somebody actually doing something and they're like, oh, that's he's doing something.
Right. He took a stand and he decided to do something.
Right.
Period. Yeah.
Anyway,
people respect that.
We've gone over by 10 minutes on this segment. Right. So let's take a break. I'll ring the bell again. And we'll come back and we'll talk about Romney 2016. Back after this.
Information.
Okay. And so, you know, I was thinking over the last few days when this Romney stuff started hitting. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've been talking about Romney potentially getting in, and we made our predictions on our prediction show just like 3 weeks ago or whatever. We're all, you know, Romney in the end, Romney won't get in. He'll pretend like he's getting in all year long, but he's not going to get in the end. And I admit there's still a chance, but for the most part, I mean, he basically jumped in this week. You know,
that's what it seems like.
I mean, he's setting up an organization. He's told the fundraisers he's interested. So, you know, on the Bitcoin thing, you missed by 12 days. You could have got it right. In this case, you know, 2 weeks into the year, we're already wrong. you know, because frankly, at this point, given how seriously he jumped in over the last week, even if he gets out before New Hampshire, he's in. Essentially,
I am shocked that he has so decisively jumped in.
You know, and
by the way, there was the worst thing today. There was a Wall Street Journal like opinion page, and they're very Republican conservative, basically ripping apart the fact that Romney is jumping in.
Yeah, okay. There have been a couple articles. You can see what they call the invisible primary happening before your eyes, no matter how invisible they say it might be, because, this is dividing the donor class. This is dividing a whole bunch of establishment Republicans.
Oh, yeah.
There are a whole bunch who are like, Romney, Romney, yay, yay. There are a whole bunch of others that say, why the hell are you coming back? We were already starting to gravitate towards Bush.
Right.
And of course, Christie's saying, how about me? How about me?
How about me? How about me?
But,
I heard that Bush had some goal of trying to raise $100 million by the summer.
Yeah.
I think at least something like that. I mean, I was just stunned by the number. I'm like, Jesus Christ, really? We're still not in the – this is for the primary. We're not close to the primaries.
Oh,
they're targeting to raise $100 million.
Yeah, well, and for going further on, I mean, we're talking about, for to go the whole distance at this point, you're talking over $1 billion.
That's what it would seem like.
But anyway, the Romney thing. Now, there's still some people who are saying Romney actually hasn't fully decided to jump in. However, he was kind of annoyed at Bush and Bush's attitude towards how he was getting in. And was basically this whole initiative is basically to tell Bush to cool his jets and take it slow. But I don't know that I buy that. I mean, some people are saying that, he's in there as a roadblock, but he'll get out before the end.
I think he's in too.
And, as I tweeted, this just makes everything oh so much more fun. I'm just like, get the popcorn popper out.
Gingrich!
Gingrich,
come on, give me some Gingrich.
I was also listening to an interview with Santorum earlier this week.
Yes!
And he's talking about, he says he'll make the decision. he says he'll make his decision late spring or early summer. But he basically sounds like he wants to get in too. It's just a matter of trying to organize it. We got Huckabee making moves. Of course, Huckabee. What can you say about Huckabee? Like, this week there was talk. There's some talk. He was talking about, he quit Fox News because he's going to run for president. Blah blah blah. And then one of the first things out of his mouth is talking about how Obama is a bad parent because he lets his kids listen to Beyonce.
Excuse me?
Yes.
Oh, God. Yeah, he's really in tune with the American pop culture.
But anyway, this will be a lot of fun because if you do have both Bush and Romney making a full-born push and Christie in there as well, those three are basically going after the establishment vote. And the typical pattern in all of these recent elections is there's very early on, one establishment guy is way ahead of all the others. And then you have the one establishment guy, and then a whole bunch of, the outsiders, the libertarian types, the religious conservative types, the whatevers, and they fight amongst themselves, and they split.
Oh my gosh, this is going to be so much fun.
And they split that vote, and then the establishment guy walks away from it. But if there's a couple of establishment guys. Yeah, if the establishment is also split.
Right.
Then it opens up the opportunity, potentially, for one of these outsiders.
Maybe McCain can run again.
To sort of, I've seen a whole bunch of things about trying to, egg on McCain. he's got to be thinking about it. Now it depends how much it splits. Like, does Christie actually?
Imagine. And Perry said that. Didn't they say Perry also?
Perry's thinking about it too.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Now, Ryan took himself out this week.
Ryan took himself out. Wow.
And it actually makes a lot of sense for him. He's looking at, you know, basically climbing the leadership in the House.
Okay. What about Rubio?
Rubio has said he's not going to allow the fact that Jeb Bush got in affect his decision on whether or not.
That's exactly right. I remember hearing that. That's right.
You know, so the key is exactly how does the split go? Because here are the important things to remember about how the primary process goes about. One, you know, basically, although in the end you need a majority at the convention, basically things are structured. So whoever has the plurality in the first few contests, things sort of snowball.
Towards him, yes.
So if you're ahead coming out of the first four or five states, it becomes increasingly difficult for anybody to challenge you going forward. And sort of the way the calendar has been structured the last few times, and they're still juggling around the calendar for 2016, so it's too early to say exactly how it's going to play out. But the last couple of times, the contests have been structured, so basically you've got four or five preliminary contests, and then you've got Super Tuesday. And there's enough at stake on Super Tuesday that basically...
After Super Tuesday, it's almost decided. And yeah. I also saw that they moved up the convention to July.
Yeah. the Republicans felt like they suffered last time for having that too late in the process.
Okay.
You know, and in general, the process was stretched out to occupy more calendar time in 2012 than it had been in previous years. So they're trying to recompress it. But like I said, there's still a lot of the calendar isn't fully set yet.
Is Dukakis still alive?
You'll have to Google that real quick.
Correct. I don't remember if Dukakis is still alive.
But
I don't know, we could get him into Democratic.
But in any case, the key is how exactly does this split? Because if there's enough of a split between the establishment folks that one of the insurgents can be looking like they're right up there in the top of the pack after the first few contests, then they potentially could have an opening, you know, because you could do the playbook in reverse.
Yeah, he's still alive.
Okay. You could do the playbook in reverse instead of the insurgent conservatives splitting their vote and making the establishment guy run away with it. You could have the establishment folks split their vote and one of the insurgents run away with it. But in order to do that, the various insurgent groups would sort of have to coalesce around somebody too. And that seems unlikely given how they're divided as well. But in all, it's a recipe for fun.
Well, you know, the one thing that we could have done, I don't know why we're drafting Jeb Bush. I just realized that older Bush only won one term. He could run again.
He could. I don't think he's up for
it. He's in bad shape, though. I just saw it. You know, I just keep hearing the news. He's really not doing very good, unfortunately. But, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But.
Jimmy Carter's 90.
Yeah. And he's still giving interviews. And,
yeah, and he's still one term, too. I mean, if we could get all the one termers out. You don't think that would be, crap. Oh, well.
Yeah. Anyway, it will be fun. We'll see. Like, one of the things, though, we'll see in this quote-unquote invisible primary phase, which is basically we're right smack in the middle of it right now. And one of the critical things to watch just over the next few weeks and a couple months at the outside is watch the money. Who is being successful at building a war chest, and who is being successful at getting important staff members and political operatives to sign up with them? Because that's where you're going to see: is there, you know, does the quote unquote establishment end up saying, "Okay, Romney looks stronger. Let's go for Romney."
Right.
Or do they say, you know, Romney has his chance. Let's go for Bush. Or do they really split right down the middle?
Right.
And does Christie get any of that support? You know, because, you know, Because Christie has had his issues, but he's over some of them.
And what about Perry? Don't people consider Perry? Well, Perry's kind of, I think he's kind of off the wall, but do they consider him mainstream?
Sort of. And actually, on that point, a 538 has a very good diagram they put out, and I just looked it up. The article name is Romney and the GOP's Five Ring Circus. The date on that is January 12th. And they have a chart that basically, it's like a Venn diagram, although technically Venn diagrams only have two, and it's called something else when it's more. But anyway, that has moderate, establishment, Christian conservative, libertarian, and Tea Party.
It's sort of
arranged like the Olympic rings. And has a whole bunch of candidates sort of on this plot into which areas they are. So Perry is essentially in the overlap area between establishment, Christian conservative, and Tea Party.
Okay. So he's somewhere in the middle there. Okay.
Right. Whereas, for instance, Bush, on the other hand, is in the overlap area between establishment and moderate.
Okay.
Paul is off by himself in libertarian land.
Right.
Ryan is on the border between establishment, libertarian, and Tea Party. You know, okay. And so there's a nice, they've got a whole bunch of these candidates and sort of map them out there. Huckabee and Santorum are by themselves in the Christian conservative camp.
Okay.
You know, and so this is a very nice little diagram because basically it shows these really are five separate constituencies within the Republican Party that are going to battle it out for the nomination. And the diagram makes them look like they're equal. They're not really equal in terms of voters or influence. In terms of influence, the establishment tends to have most of the money. And establishment, I think, also includes your sort of Wall Street economic conservative types. Are in the establishment bubble. But, you know, we've also got, you know, the sort of Tea Party, Christian conservative types have tended to be better on turnout. And that's why they end up often controlling primary races or having outsized influence on primary races. So we'll see how this all meshes up. Again, it'll be fun, and a lot will depend. We should, you know more by the time we get to December and we're doing our next prediction show before a single vote has been cast. We'll have a better idea of sort of where support is really lining up in terms of the money behind the scenes, the political operatives behind the scenes, all of that kind of thing. And that's by no means an end-all be-all. They don't always win, but it is a very important factor. And so if you see all of those people lining up behind one of the establishment figures, then that establishment figure is going to have a very, very good chance of winning the whole thing. If, however, they're split, then, you know, these other guys have a shot.
No. Yep. Okay, well.
And we're out of time.
We're out of time.
So it's the end of the show. Thanks everybody again for listening. We appreciate your listenership. I'm abelsmay@abelsmay.com on email. You can find us both on Twitter. I'm at abelsmay. Yvonne is at imbo. We love hearing from you on all of this stuff. Tell your friends about the show, review us online, all of that kind of stuff. You know, and actually, if you want to like donate us money to buy a pizza or something, we'll eat pizza too.
Yay!
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for joining us. We're out of here. Have a good week, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.